The thing about people at work, I've discovered, is they are very resilient. They might not have a lot of other good qualities, but in terms of being able to absorb pain or feedback or stuff, I've got really almost nasty feedback about some people. And I've watered it down a little bit, but essentially given it to them and felt bad, but they used it. At first, they might have sulked and felt like, I don't like this. A month later, they absorbed it. Sometimes they change more, sometimes they change less, but they always took it. And I couldn't feel more gratitude at their capability for being able to do that.
Welcome to the Work Matters podcast. This is Thomas Bertels. Even the best athletes in the world have coaches. Not because they lack skill, but because high performance requires continuous feedback and refinement. Leadership is similar. Executive coaching matters because the higher someone rises in an organization, the fewer honest mirrors they have. Authority creates distance. Distance reduces feedback. Coaching helps close that gap. Jeremy Robinson has not only coached hundreds of executives himself, he also founded two training programs, the executive coaching program at UPenn's Wharton School of Business and iCoach Global, a virtual executive coach training program, which is accredited by the ICF as a level one program. In this episode, Jeremy and I discuss how coaching shifted from fixing problems to developing high performers and what the ingredients of a good coaching program are: clear eligibility, time, 360-degree feedback with stakeholder input, public goals, and confidentiality. Jeremy explains the role of coaching as providing the follow-up tail missing from leadership training and argues AI cannot replace human attachment. Whether you're an exec who wants to work on his leadership skills or an HR executive looking to establish a coaching program, this episode offers lots of practical insights. I hope you enjoy this episode, and if you do, don't forget to like, subscribe, and share. Jeremy, welcome to Work Matters.
Thank you, Thomas. It's a pleasure to be with you.
It's a pleasure to have you on. So we're going to talk about executive coaching, but you started your career as a writer, a poet, a newspaper reporter. So give us a little bit how you got into executive coaching, how you got started in that field.
The story. I was very quick to realize I was not going to make a living as a poet unless I became an academic, which was not really that interesting to me. Although I did love writing poetry and I loved meeting some really cool poets who mentored me. And I wrote a novel while I was working as a newspaper reporter. Working as a newspaper reporter was enormous fun for me. I liked writing on deadline. I liked the city editor standing over my desk and I had 20 minutes to go. And he said, I need two takes or three takes. I had one of those old Royal typewriters. You had to pound like crazy to get it up. So that was fun. What I didn't like about being a newspaper reporter was you got to watch what was going on, but you didn't get to help. So that was strange to me. If you go to a fire, you're there watching the people put out the fire and you're taking notes. That was very strange. I liked the writing part of that, but I didn't like the loneliness of it. So I started to think, what is similar to this that involves some kind of professional something or other, or another human being might be involved? What I stumbled upon was becoming a psychotherapist. So I went off to the social work school where I got a certification as a clinical social worker and then subsequently training in psychotherapy at a place called the Postgraduate Center for Mental Health, which was the place at the time for social workers and psychologists to get trained as psychodynamic psychotherapists. In my third year of doing that, I took a required course called Mental Health Consultation, which was required of all the fellows, we would call fellows. And that was really coaching. It was applying the skills of being a therapist to the workplace. So I had a client, it was actually at Jacoby Hospital, where I'm still affiliated now, I'm on the faculty of Albert Einstein College of Medicine, where you're supposed to coach somebody in the workplace for 3 months about some issue they had. And this woman was now the boss of somebody that she was previously the peer of. So I coached her for 3 months. I wrote a paper. I had a supervisor. It was an interesting model because that's a model that we use now. I have executive coach training program. I coach global. So I did that. I liked it a lot. Nobody else in the program liked it. They were there to become psychotherapists. They didn't like this consulting stuff. This was a required course in the program. So I eventually became an assistant in a program and ultimately the head of it for a couple of years. And along that time, I met some big players in the world of organizational psychology and met a guy named Harry Levinson, who wrote a famous book called Organizational Diagnosis. I did some work in the Tavistock stuff, but I could not get any headway as an executive coach. I was like wandering the desert, a man without a country. Fortunately, I had this successful psychotherapy practice. I was good at helping people, which I liked. Until Daniel Goleman came out with his book in 1995, bam, emotional intelligence. So now it got easy for me. I just had to say, here, see this book? You want me to do this with your leaders? I think I can do this. Let's try. So I got into some pretty big Fortune 500 companies, and I started doing it, and surprise, surprise, I was very good at it. A lot of the way that business worked and still works is through coaching chemistry meetings. So you would be one of three coaches. You would meet with a client who is eligible for coaching. You talk to them for 45 minutes or an hour, and they would pick who they want to be coached by. So with this one company, I won 90% of my coaching chemistry meeting. I sometimes wondered what it would have been like if I lost 90%, but I didn't. Anyway, so I got very involved in that organization, other organizations, and I was off to the races as an executive coach.
I think historically, people would look at coaching as like fixing a problem. Maybe he's not listening enough, or he's not collegial enough or collaborative enough. That has changed over the years, right? So I think now we're looking at coaching as an investment in good people, helping good people get better, right?
Yeah, that's the good way of looking at it. But unfortunately, the shadow side of that that you just mentioned still remains. And it's still, in some cases, especially among, I should say this softly, law firms and medical practices, that's still there. Because the idea is, let's just give everybody coaching. Okay, so there is Dr. John over there, and he's derailing, and he's on a pick. We're going to give him coaching. So what do all the other doctors in the hospital think about that if they see Dr. John go for coaching? I'm not going to touch that. I don't want any of that.
Maybe like flipping it around, what are, in your view, is like some of the ingredients of a successful coaching relationship?
I think it's up to an organization to develop a really good design for executive coaching, meaning that you rule out derailing people, not people who have derailing characteristics. Everybody has that. But people who are on a pick, the derailing, you rule them out. And this organization, this formal organization where I was very successful, they had a great design. If you were a senior executive or high potential, you got to have coaching, no questions asked. So it was like, okay, you didn't have to go through another hurdle. It was just like, you're at this level, you're really good, we'll find you a coach. And then they had a panel of coaches, faculty of coaches that they would source. And everybody who wanted coaching raised their hand. They got a choice of three coaches that the head of coaching would assign to that person. They would pick one, and the person we got coaching was all paid for by the organization for 6 months, so it was a sufficient length of time. It was an SOW that the organization had. It required a 360, which was essential. Coach could also use other assessments, like I use emotional intelligence, EQI 2.0 assessment. So that all made for a very robust coaching experience for a client to have in that organization. Unfortunately, few other coaching organizations that I encountered put that kind of thoughtfulness into designing coaching. It was random. Like, you got it maybe if you had a good HR partner and the HR partner understood something about coaching, and the organization understood something about coaching. But still, back in the day, there was that article in Economist magazine in 2003, is coaching a fad? It was a big question, is coaching a fad? After most organizations decided, okay, we're not going to do coaching for derailing people, we're going to send them to outplacement, then it was decided that coaching should include, and this was Marshall Goldsmith's contribution, should include a 360 survey. Then coaching wasn't a fan anymore. Why? Because you're getting a 360, which you need to know. Why do you need to know it? Because you want to be able to see around corners to find out what your key stakeholders are saying about you. And if you don't find out that information, you will probably continue to make the same errors that you've made previously. So that was game-changing. And that was the sort of the moment when coaching overcame that Harvard Business Review article, The Wild West of Coaching. It was going well for a while. It looked like coaching was having a moment. More recently, there's been coaching platforms coming in. I won't mention names, but it's like one and done coaching. We're calling it executive coaching. It's one or two sessions, and we're calling it executive coaching. There's no 360, there's no follow-up, there's no boss involvement, there's no stakeholders, but we're going to give it a name. We're going to call it coaching. Okay, what you might call it, flying to the moon. But that's what it was. Originally, coaching originated because training was intense, and people loved it, but they couldn't follow up on all the information. You have 3 days, 5 days, whatever, it was great, and then you come back to the office and you forget 90%. So let's put a tail on it. That became coaching. Let's add ongoing sessions because people can absorb so much information in a given time. The neuropsychologist said 3 or 4 things. All right, so that made for a good experience. But going back where we were regressing in the world of coaching to coaching platforms, now we're going back to training. That's what it is. And we're calling it coaching. And we have also, I've been told by my HR colleagues, dial a coach. You can dial a coach for this. And that coach in one session will figure out what's going on for your issues in terms of your leadership. I'd like to be able to do that.
That's the next level, right? We all aspire to that.
And next level of genius.
So walk us through like a typical coaching engagement. So when you engage with a client, what does it look like?
Beyond the coaching chemistry meeting, you decide to work together. There is an arc of executive coaching. There is a beginning, what we call a felt need, that the people and the stakeholders and the client have about their goals to work on together. And that, through early working on stuff and coaching sessions and getting information from stakeholders, turns into a negotiated goal. So there's a felt need, which is a kind of a pre-goal, turns into a negotiated goal, which is the actual goal of coaching, which is public to the stakeholders, not confidential. Needs to be public because the coach needs to get information from stakeholders about whether the coaching client is progressing or not. They're working on some of the stuff they need to work on or not. And then within that, there is assessments that are given by the coach, which are confidential in terms of their content, and discussed, hopefully highlight some of the behaviors the coaching client should work on. And there's a 360 survey where the coach interviews, say, 12 stakeholders around the coaching client, including the boss who doesn't have anonymity, and gives feedback to the coaching client. So that's at the top of the arc. And that's the cathartic moment of coaching. Aristotle said the catharsis was the highlight of trauma. The 360 is the cathartic moment of coaching. Sometimes it's painful, sometimes it's pleasurable. Mostly it's both. Where for some reason, people who have been around this person working for maybe 15 years, some of them, have never told John these things because they like John. Well, I don't want to tell John that he really does not have a good sense of executive presence. I'm not going to tell that to John. He's a great guy. What am I going to say to them? But I come along, the stranger, they never met before. I ingratiate myself to them in the first 5 minutes of the interview, and I ask textured questions so that they say, John, executive presence is not there, and that's probably one reason they'll never be a high-level leader in this organization. So I collect all this feedback. I go back to John and I give him this feedback. And this is painful, but it's also good because I need to hear this information. I haven't heard it before. We put that into a coaching development plan, which I co-write with John. Then we do a coaching development plan meeting with he and the boss and the coach. He runs the meeting. I, as the coach, facilitate the meeting. The coaching development plan is also a document that the boss gets. And then subsequently, John and I work on all that stuff that comes out of the coaching development plan and the CEPA.
In your experience, obviously hard to generalize, but are executives typically surprised by what comes out of the 360? Like they had a completely different view of themselves?
No, they have some idea.
Yeah.
Maybe if they haven't heard from their colleague, they've heard from their partner or the spouse. No, they have some idea. Actually, what they're surprised by is the level. They might be surprised that their people are saying the camel has two humps and they're saying the camel has one hump. But what they're surprised is everybody is saying. They're like, they're the only one who hasn't been let in on the secret of this, the deficiency that they have. I guess the other untold story about executive coaching, which coaches know, is it can be amazingly powerful. We can change people's lives. I work with a guy, I tell this story a lot, in financial services, and I was about to go in and meet him, and I said to the HR person as I was heading towards the guy's office, what's he like? And HR guy said, you'll see, his voice trailing off into the mist. And what he should have said was, robotic. He was a robot. He was a brilliant robot. He was supposed to be employee number 6 of a very well-known tech company. He was brilliant. But you know what? That wasn't working too well with his employees that he was supposed to teach and mentor. They didn't find him at all useful. Great that he was brilliant. Great that he had great ideas. Great that he whatever. But he was missing a key element. He had no emotional intelligence. Right in my wheelhouse. So I told him, and the good thing was he wasn't getting promotion, so he was in pain. That's a perfect coaching client, somebody who has pain. So he had pain, was blocking his growth path in terms of his leadership. And I told him if he wanted to do this with me, I was going to do coaching surgery. I was going to go into his head to reach his heart. And he did it. He read all the stuff I gave him on emotional intelligence. And then he absorbed it. It was painful to him to absorb. He could sometimes just do a 45-minute session with me. And then it was like, I had to get out of there. That was like, that was enough. Okay, I'm good. I don't need it. He was getting it, though. So when we got to the six-month part and we renewed, the boss said to me, what did you do? I never expected anything to happen. And my joke to him was, why did you hire him if you never expect anything to happen? Because I expect something to happen because I'm not here to waste my time. I'm not here to waste your money. It's going to happen. Something's going to happen because you increase the pain and then the people have to respond or say, get out of here. I can't stand this anymore. The thing about people at work I've discovered is they are very resilient. They might not have a lot of other good qualities, but in terms of being able to absorb pain or feedback or stuff that's, I've gotten really almost nasty feedback about some people. And I've watered it down a little bit, but essentially given it to them and felt like, I feel bad, but this is what I'm supposed to do. And they used it. At first, they might have sulked and felt like, I don't like this. After a month later, they absorbed it. Sometimes they change more, sometimes they change less, but they always took it. And I couldn't feel more sense of gratitude at their capability for being able to do that.
So that brings up an interesting question. So if you think about all the people you've coached in your career, so who was your favorite, if there are favorites, but let's say you had like favorite clients, where you're like, this was my best work, was the most. Is it the ones that are the hardest nuts to crack that give you the most enjoyment?
Every coaching client is somebody who I'm still coaching. 20 years later, actually 20 years later with some years off in between. And part of that, at least half of the time, which does not speak well for my business capability, was for free by me because she didn't have the company to sponsor her and I didn't want to take her money. But I liked working with her a lot. So I said, okay, this is on me. And when she was able to be in an advanced level position in a pharma company, she hired me. So what was so great about this person? African-American, Caribbean, or American woman. My first coaching session with her was part of a women's coaching program at a well-known consulting company. And she's on the phone telling me about the first 5 minutes, telling me that her boss has just told her she's not entrepreneurial enough. And then she told me she has this high-pressure consulting job. She owns her own house. She owns a real estate development piece of property somewhere where she's in. And she owns two other pieces of property. She's not entrepreneurial. She told this stuff to me. I started laughing so hard, I dropped the phone. And she was laughing also. And she liked that I got her dilemma about being seen, which is common for African-American female executives, very common, unfortunately. So we were off to the races, and I've done a lot of work since in terms of her visibility in the organization and her capability. And my style is very direct, so she responds to that very well, and she uses it very well. The funny part is when she referred me to a colleague of hers who said, "What's he like?" She was describing not my physical attributes, but how I get results. And she said, "He's Mr. Miyagi." Well, myself, I'm like, "Mr. Miyagi? Paint the fence? Okay, I guess he means I'm effective." So that's good.
How important is chemistry?
It's somewhat important. Yeah, you definitely need it, but it can be a problem. Also, I've had a problem with some clients. I loved them. I felt they were very much like me. And boy, did I just weren't when they took a left turn and I was surprised. My hypothesis about them turned out to be wrong or was overstated, or maybe I overstated their strengths and I missed some important pieces. So chemistry is good. Maybe too much chemistry is not so good. It's so many things in life that are a balance.
I would imagine that the HR department plays a big part of people coaching support.
Right.
What does HR get right, get wrong about coaching?
Such a great question, because in the best of all possible worlds, HR would be like the kind of coaching, HR support that my colleague Carol Wasilishin got when she was doing, I can mention the names because this has all been publicized, at Ramin Haas. So this senior HR person came to Carol and said, "We need to go inside out. We need to go inside," meaning that their executives were too nice and the organization was not as competitive as a chemical company as it could have been because of this deficiency. And he felt that Carol had the capability, using some of her background as a psychologist, in addition to being an executive coach, to provide the feedback and coaching to help them alter their character style somewhat. So he, over time, made a big commitment, which, amazing commitment by an HR leader, to refer all these leaders at Ramin Haas to her. 90 leaders over 10 years, 90 leaders she coached. And she was consistent to the point that when they did some survey later on, this has all been publicized in an article she wrote with the former CEO of Ramin Haas. 20 of those leaders became CEOs at other companies, 20. So I guess she must have done a good job coaching. But that was a big risk that HR leader took. He made a big bet on coaching and on Carol Wasilishin. I don't know of a lot of HR leaders who have the intelligence, the capability, and the risk tolerance to make that kind of bet. I sure wish there were, because I think that too many HR leaders are not either knowledgeable enough about executive coaching, not invested enough in executive coaching, and not willing to take the risk enough for executive coaching. Because if you get the right coach in the right circumstances, you can get that kind of result. It's possible. She proved it. It's possible. But it's that doesn't happen enough. And therefore, the gift that is executive coaching often gets wasted. Or it gets wasted by the HR leader not using it well, or the coach who appears to be a good coach, but they don't ask the senior executives, what should I know? And they do the coaching in kind of isolated way from the organization. That is really a big disappointment to me.
I have a colleague of mine who does first 100-day coaching. So you bring in a new leader, you just hired them for, I don't know, $500,000 plus options fully loaded. And then you put them into this new organization and you give them zero support to get started, to get through the first 100 days and figure out what the priorities are. And he's eternally frustrated by it because it's such a disservice to the individual and to the organization. And it's such a small investment, right, to protect an even larger investment you already made. But still, there's not a whole lot of people invest in that. I think it's probably similar for executive coaching.
It's called onboarding executive coaching. Mm-hmm. They trained me to do that at this pharmaceutical company. And they had a consultant put up some numbers. And they said, and this blows my mind, for somebody making, I don't know, it was like $130,000 a year, small amount, relatively speaking, that 50% of those people don't succeed. Those people are onboarding. 50. And the cost is $2 million in terms of hiring again, all the ancillary stuff that goes into it. So $2 million, you want to hire a coach for a year, you're going to spend like whatever, $50,000, $70,000, $80,000. You can't spend $80,000 to save $2 million. This is madness. The coach can do a lot of stuff with that onboarding executive, including speed up the process of getting to know the people around that person.
I couldn't agree more. It's penny wise, pound foolish.
Yeah.
But still, it's like not a whole lot of people investing in it. So what makes a good coaching program design? I know that you have a really interesting one, and I want you to talk about what you do differently.
I train folks who are executive coaches, been doing that for 23 years, who have maybe another expertise. Like we have doctors, we have quite a few lawyers, quite a few HR people, various random folks, but they all have usually an advanced degree. They tend to be in midlife. They've had substantial life experience and professional experience. They have a skill set. They just don't have a coaching skill set. And one of the things that differentiates our program is we find an actual coaching case, i.e. a coaching practicum, where they coach a real coaching client that they coach and they make up the questions on the 360 and they meet with every week and they do a coaching development plan, all that stuff over 3 months. So they actually learn it by doing it in addition to the classes they get. But I think you're also talking about what about in an organization, how could they do a better job of designing it? They could do a better job of designing it by just thinking in terms of what are the elements they need. They need to have a panel, a faculty of executive coaches that they can rely on. They need to have a criteria for who gets executive coaching and who doesn't. And they need to have an absolute limitation against any kind of derailing coaching being given if they don't want to completely screw up the program, because the visibility of people getting coaching who are derailing will be seen very quickly by others who will not want the coaching. So that will become problematic. So given those elements and having it be robust enough, that's the most important differentiator. That you are going to take the risk to pay for, maybe in an organization of 150,000 people, thousands of people going through the coaching, that maybe you're going to pay for over 15 years, 5,000 or 10,000 people who get coaching. And that's $1 million number. So that means you're believing in this stuff enough that it's going to attract talent and it's going to create kind of a mythology around development in your organization that's going to have a knock-on effect. It's going to affect the coaching client, but it's going to also affect all the stakeholders, the boss, the HR partner, but all the other stakeholders who know that person. They are seeing that this organization is investing in coaching. And guess what's going to happen to engagement scores? Because it's a development organization.
I'm just being provocative here a bit, but a lot of companies have leadership development programs, send people to Harvard, MIT, around the world. Don't those programs give people the skills that they need? Why do I need to spend even more money on one-on-one coaching?
I taught in one of those programs at Wharton. We did an executive coach training program for 2 different years. I was impressed. We had 30 people 1 year. Somebody's there for the first time. Somebody's there from Italy. Somebody's there from Chile. People coming from faraway places to be with us for a week. So here's the problem. The same problem in training. Very inspiring people. Their neurons get firing. They come away. They're great. They love it. They love it. It's been a week being together. They've learned an enormous amount. Then the next week happened. How much do they retain?
5%, 10%.
Yeah. Okay, so say they're great. Say they retain 10%. But you need to have a tail. How do you reinforce the learning? That's the coaching part. So I was running a coaching program at Wharton, which was really a training program. It didn't have a tail. So I thought, this is not what I should be doing. So that's the problem with that. It's not coaching enough. We all forget stuff. We all are resistant to stuff. Wendy Wood wrote a book called Good Habits, Bad Habits, and she studied habits, which is essentially what we're doing with coaching, is change behaviors and habits. She and her researchers discovered it takes 93 days. That's a lot of time to change a habit. People go to the gym for 30 days. They're out. They're disappointed. They try a new diet for 60 days. They're disappointed. 93 days, that's 3 months. That's a quarter of a year. That's a while to stay with something.
That's interesting. I think that's true. I honestly see the same thing in my work, that you got to do something. You got to commit to it for 90 days to really make it stick.
You got to wear it out. I want to say one other thing about coaching and psychology is that one of the wonderful beneficiaries of why executive coaching has become at all popular now is because of something called positive psychology. Martin Seligman wrote a book called Authentic Happiness. But more than that, Martin Seligman writing a book called Authentic Happiness is he got a lot of funders to come in and fund. You have people writing books. You have Angela Duckworth writing a book called Grit. You have Barbara Fredrickson writing a book called Positivity. You got all these folks writing these books and doing this great research, in addition to the work on emotional intelligence being out there, in addition to the work that Cooper Reiter did on Appreciative of Inquiry being out there. Well, all this stuff is coming behind the idea that positive psychology is a study of virtue, not illness. We're going to study what's virtuous in people, what is good in people. And that's a really interesting departure in terms of psychology now becoming developmental and less frightening to people to think about and talk about. Who's a beneficiary of people who are doing executive coaching? It should be people who are doing HR also, if they're reading that stuff. It should be. But a lot of people in HR are not reading that stuff. I don't know why.
I don't know either, but I'm equally surprised by it because HR people know a lot of this stuff. My personal pet peeve is work design, job design. That's being taught. HR people at some point pick these things up, but they don't practice it. They don't apply it in their work. And I think it's a big gap. I have a colleague of mine, Bob Aubrey, who argues that instead of human resources, we should really look at this as human development.
Yes.
But he also makes the point that it would probably be a different function, right? Because the HR function, I think, is a little bit too tainted with protect the company from the employees and make sure everything is compliant. I think it's like a different mindset.
Right? I also think that the, I want to call it hysteria and excitement around AI is so interesting in terms of the absence of information to combat it. Yes, AI is going to change the world, and yes, AI is powerful, but you know what? There's something called human attachment, which seems to be necessary to our living and breathing. They did a study in the 1930s in the United States where babies were not held. And you know what happened? Many of them died because they didn't have human contact. They died. No other disease. They just died. They weren't being held. Whoa.
You feel pretty secure that you're not going to get replaced by an AI coach, it seems.
If you want the people committing suicide and dying and getting depression, yeah, give them AI coaches. That's great for them. It'll probably reduce the population also. But there's this attachment, this human contact that seems to be necessary to our being.
I find it super interesting. I think we always have two minds. On the one side, we say, we know how enjoyable it is to be with people, be part of a winning team, be part of a team that works well together. We're all in relationships, right? There's a reason why. But on the flip side, there's also a little bit Sartre, hell is other people. These darn employees that don't do what I want them to do. So it's sometimes we like people, but I think what's appealing to leaders about AI is this, yes, boss. Right? How much, right? How soon, how quick would you like me to cook up the next step? There's not this,
right?
There's not the human element that says, are you sure about this? Right. I think it's very seductive because it has this instant gratification that I think a lot of people are looking for.
Yeah, it does beg the question, though, in terms of the work that Amy Edmondson did about psychological safety. Okay, so what about that? What about the fact that when Google did their whatever study, they discovered that really what works with people is having the psychologically safe groups, i.e. where people have a sense of belonging, they feel respected and appreciated, and they can speak up. I was shocked by Amy Edmondson's work was the problem is silence. The problem is the guy at Morton Feigl not speaking up about the O-rings. The problem was the co-pilot in the seat next to the pilot not saying something to the pilot. Hey, there's a plane heading towards us. We need to stop. But he didn't, and he died. He didn't speak up, and he died. That's nuts. But that's us, human beings.
One statistic that I always question a little bit is 70% of large transformation programs fail. And why do they fail? It's because of resistance to change. I think, quite frankly, I think a lot of these ideas fail because they were really dumb ideas to begin with. And nobody said anything.
I love your take on it. It's great.
No, we were both, if I'd been around organizations, I remember a very large, well-known consulting firm deliver the design for a shared service organization where people had three different bosses, a three-dimensional matrix. I believe that you can make a matrix work, but it takes a lot of work.
Yes.
But only two dimensions. Three, it's like a step too far.
It's like a head too many.
I think it seems blatantly obvious that wouldn't work. Well, $100 million later, we know.
And nobody said anything while they were doing the design.
I'm pretty sure there was an HR person that in the back of their mind said,
this is not a good idea.
Yeah, to your point, I think that psychological safety is important. And I guess that maybe also speaks to the coaching relationship. Because in organizations, if you're at the top of the organization, the air gets thin. It gets very political. A friend of mine, we're talking about her boss, and she says, you don't get to that level unless you're like a very experienced cage fighter. And I would agree. The people who really get to the top.
Yep.
Yes, they're smart, they're driven, they can do hard things, but the oxygen gets a little thin up there. Right.
Yep.
So I think a lot of them, I think, need or would benefit from having a trusted relationship where they can unpack what they really can't unpack with colleagues in their organization.
You would almost want them to have it just to be able to have somebody push back sometimes to say, I think maybe you should go take a long walk in the park or something like that and think that out, because I don't think that comes out the way you want it to come out.
Yeah. And they don't have many other people to talk to.
They don't. It's a excruciating job, an excruciating schedule, and then the people that you may be trusting to talk to turns out maybe one is sabotaging you. And then you quickly decide not to do that too often.
For good reasons. So you have this really interesting coaching program. I think what's really unique about it is that you actually have people do a real coaching engagement. Tell us a little bit more about this program.
We have admissions qualifications. If you want to go to brand name, I won't mention it, Ivy League coaching program, write a check, you're in. No, we don't do write a check coaching. We have a small cohort. It's a boutique. We're all together the whole 15 weeks online. I got to have people in there who get along with each other, not in the sense of being nice, but being respectful, having empathy, all the things you want them to do as a coach, and have a sense of not monopolizing conversations, listening. So we need to vet those people. And then the third thing is that we have them write a paper on the question that HR asks them about coaching. What is your approach to coaching? Which they develop in the course of actually coaching somebody. So learn by doing, approach to coaching, good quality interactions of people together. And we're not greedy. We do this program once a year with a limited number of people. We're not trying to rule the world. We're just trying to change a little piece of it.
So where can people go to learn more about this program?
It's thank you, www.highcoachglobal.com. And I'll be happy to talk to you. And you know what? You don't have to be interested in applying. You just want to know something. What we think about a good setup of executive coaching. We train our coaches also to do that. That you can be a coach also, but we think you should be a consultant because now you know more about executive coaching than most people. You can be a consultant in setting up a coaching program. You want to do an internal coaching program, take notes of what you've learned together and bring that to your organization, your law firm, and be rigorous about how you do it. But make sure that you're the subject matter experts when they start to tell you, no, you shouldn't do it that way. You got to be able to be fierce in pushing back on especially issues of who the coaching client is. That's a problem. Organizations that think, because I pay, I have access to all the information in coaching, think that that's a model that's going to work. Good luck, fella. Because if I'm a coaching client, I don't want you having my information. I don't care if you pay $3 million. You can't have it. You don't own me. You need to respect the fact that coaching requires confidentiality to work. Yes, the goals are public. So you do have some idea of how things are going, morphing and changing by having the process. But the coaching content needs to be confidential, and that needs to be sacred. There's a line in the sand to every really good executive coach I know.
So we're going to put a link to your program into the show notes so people can find that, and also to your profile. I'm also going to put a link, and you wrote this really interesting piece about the 10 commandments about executive coaching, which I thought was really helpful. And you also written or co-written a book on the topic, which I also found very helpful. It's a tome, right? There's a lot of good information in there.
Yeah, we wrote this 13, 14 years ago, still in print, becoming an additional executive coach. By the way, exceptional was the publisher's idea. That wasn't our word, but they wanted to sell books, and they are still selling them. And then we found out that it's still selling, and it's being used in some MBA programs.
That is very, I think that's shocking.
Yeah, these ones are your toes.
Listen, Jeremy, it was a real treat to have you on the show. Thank you so much for sharing some of your hard-earned wisdom about coaching. Again, I'd highly recommend people check out your work and reach out to you if they have questions. Again, thank you so much for coming on the show.
And thank you for your generosity and your wisdom and your sense of humor. Much appreciated.
We hope you enjoyed this discussion. If you did, be sure to subscribe, like, share, or comment. Until next time, let's make work matter.